The following program was recorded at Voice Core Reading Service, Columbus, Ohio. For more information on audio information services for the visually impaired, we invite you to visit voicecore.org. That's voicecore, voicecorps.org.
My name is Casey Coars from the Casey Coars Show, and I'll be talking with Stephen Cousisteau. And we'll be discussing Mr. Cousisteau's new book called Eavesdropping. And first of all, Stephen, did I get the pronunciation correct?
Well, it's a funny name, Cousisteau. It's sort of like Jacques Cousteau, but with an extra is in it. So it's Cousisteau.
Excellent. Thank you.
And when you step off a plane in Finland, they'll now understand you.
Excellent. Excellent. And the book that I'm looking at here is a book that has recently been published by Norton called Eavesdropping, a memoir of blindness and listening. It has a beautiful dust jacket of you sitting out in a chair looking out over the ocean. And this is the first book you've written since Planet of the Blind back in 1998. And as I was reading the book, Stephen, there was a... You were doing a talk, and you were at the Carroll Center, and you wrote that suddenly a woman called out from the back of the room, and her voice was fierce, and she says, "Why travel anywhere if you can't see?" she asked. Was that when the idea was born for eavesdropping?
You know, it's interesting. The idea came shortly after that moment. It wasn't immediately following the question. It came slowly to me, in the way that things do when you ponder, say, a spiritual question or a psychological question, something that's difficult. Just to fill the readers in, I was at the Carroll Center, which is a great nonprofit organization serving blind and visually impaired adults and children in Boston. And on that particular day, I had been talking about the joys of traveling with a guide dog. At the time, I had my first guide dog, Corky, a yellow Labrador retriever from Guiding Eyes for the Blind. Today, here in our studios, we have Vidal, my second guide from Guiding Eyes, also a yellow lab. And I thought I'd done a pretty good job of talking about the joys of traveling with a trained guide dog. And when I got done, lo and behold, this woman who was newly blind in her middle 50s really revealed how sad she was and how depressed, and mm-hmm. and you could hear in her question that sense that there might be no place to go. And I tried to reply quickly in the way that maybe stand-up comics do. You know, mm-hmm. I said, "Hey, they got great hot dogs in Milwaukee," mm-hmm. and you know, crab cakes in Baltimore, and then we moved on. And I went home and thought about it, and I thought about it for about 2 months and realized that deeply buried in that question is both a neurological and a spiritual problem. The neurological problem is, how do you replace the endorphins that we know we get in the brain when we see? The eye is just like a chocolate bar, a great generator of endorphins in the visual centers of the brain. You can read about that if you read neurological magazines, or Oliver Sacks has written about this and so forth. And the second question is really, what's the virtue of imagining a life of pleasure, a life of aesthetic pleasure, of wonder, if you feel that doors are shut to you? You know, how would you go forward in the world and sightsee by ear? Mm-hmm. How would you imagine enjoying yourself? And I hadn't answered that question at all. So then I began to think about the question, and I looked at journals having to do with the rehabilitation of the blind, and journals having to do with poetry and literature, and I couldn't find a book on the subject. You know, mm-hmm. why travel anywhere if you can't see? Mm-hmm. And so that's when it dawned on me that it's the kind of thing writers uncover, that writing creatively is, as you know, always about answering a mystery of some kind, mm-hmm. whether it's a public mystery or a personal one. And that was the mystery. How could I convince someone who was in that woman's position that traveling by ear, for instance, is in fact a beautiful, wonderful, and to be desired thing?
Mm-hmm. And in Eavesdropping, you You have done it through writing what are, in essence, a group of essays or kind of postcards in cases about some of the experiences that you've had. And if you would, talk for a moment about how you constructed it, because it does have a bit of a linear feel to it, that it does start with childhood and does progress through your adult years, but not necessarily in what like a typical memoir fashion would do.
Correct. Yeah. Well, you know, I started by asking myself a basic question. What's my earliest memory of listening?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll notice there's a quotation in the book from Igor Stravinsky, who essentially says that anybody can hear. A duck can hear.
Mm-hmm.
But listening, that's the hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
That really discerning and thinking about what is coming in through your ears, making sense of it, being imaginative with it, that's the harder part. And so I thought, well, when do I really recall first hearing something and that experience being something very powerful? And I remembered suddenly being back in Helsinki, Finland, as a young boy, maybe 4 years old, standing with my father on a dock going out into the frozen Baltic. Helsinki's on the same latitude as Anchorage, Alaska, so it's a very cold, dark northern city. And lo and behold, there were these elderly women beating their carpets on racks down by the sea and singing old, mournful Scandinavian folk songs. You can actually visit the Finnish Literature Foundation and listen to some of those folk songs online. They come from the cycle of poems called Kalevala, and they're very powerful, mournful Nordic blues songs. And my father said to me, "Listen, those are the old songs." And I remember being struck with wonder by the depth and strangeness of that music. And so that was a very early memory that I had really not recalled. And so that got me started. I realized there are all kinds of instances when in childhood, as a blind child, I had joy from listening.
Mm-hmm.
So my method then became to write, as you would say, postcards or prose poems. They're invariably poetic in the sense that I try to capture the flavor, the feeling, what I think things might have looked like as they were happening, as well as to make analogies between sounds and the inner life of a person. And so I did a series of scene-by-scene constructions based on childhood memories, right on up until I'm about 14, 15 years old. Then I switched the book to adult travel,
mm-hmm.
And the book becomes more, I think, diffuse at that point. It becomes a series of travel logs.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the opening of the book is sequential from the age of about 4 up to about 14, 15, year by year, different experiences of listening.
Yes, and you use a word that that I love, synesthesia, in... you experienced a glass blower, and it was the first time you'd experienced synesthesia. And for the listeners, why don't you explain what synesthesia is? It's more common than people realize, and Jimi Hendrix supposedly had synesthesia around the color purple. The song Purple Haze is an example of synesthesia. When purple meant something and he saw something else, Hendrix did when he played the guitar.
Synesthesia is basically the translation of one sense into another. So that if you are hearing music, you can also be, in a sense, experiencing it through another one of your senses. So that you might be smelling it or tasting it. Or a color could produce in you, a kind of aesthetic experience not normally associated with color. So in a way, it's a kind of deepening of the senses as they unfold and play beautiful tricks on us.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimi Hendrix, in fact, was, if he were alive today, I'm sure he would even be speaking about it. He was someone who had bipolar depression,
mm-hmm.
and was either way up or way down. And the color purple for him brought in both temperature and certain smells and flavors of childhood, and he would actually experience these things.
Mm-hmm.
So when he says purple haze all through my brain, he's having a very deep experience.
Yeah, exactly. And Stephen, when we talked a bit earlier, one of the common themes in eavesdropping and Planet of the Blind was your childhood, growing up, that your childhood, a lot of time you spent alone, and you formed deep attachments to music, and your love of music and the importance of music, Caruso, throughout eavesdropping, the Buena Vista Social Club. Music has always been an important part of your life, hasn't it?
I think it's been an important part of almost everyone's life,
yes.
Hasn't it?
I mean, yes.
But yes, it certainly was a antidote to a lot of early solitude. I mean, for readers or listeners out there, you know, in the late 50s and early 60s, I explain this in the book, but it wasn't customary for disabled children to really circulate much with the others, right? The, mm-hmm. the normative children. And, you know, you did spend some time alone. And so I discovered my grandmother's old Victrola up in the attic of her house. And, you know, miraculously, it still worked. And there were all these Caruso records and old, you know, jazz standards and things like that. I'd sit up there in the attic cranking away on that Victrola and listening to really strange stuff for a little mm-hmm. little boy to be, mm-hmm. you know, exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was thrilled by it, as I suppose countless generations have been thrilled by the great tenor Caruso.
Mm-hmm.
I was thrilled by it too, though I didn't fully understand what at first it was, or where it came from, or who he was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you could feel the passion and the darkness and the joy in it all at once. And that was my first opening to a world of recorded sounds. I also describe how in my early childhood, the transistor radio didn't yet exist. And so one could actually wander all day out in the woods of New Hampshire and not be listening to an iPod or the top 40, that we were probably that last generation of children who had some unmediated listening,
mm-hmm.
Which is also a kind of historical thing.
Mm-hmm.
That world is gone now.
Yes. Yes, it is. You write that as you were working on eavesdropping and as you were developing your listening skills, you said, I was attempting to raise the ante around the art of listening. I wanted to be a listener, and by this I meant I wanted to be a happy man. And I think that's a very wise statement. I think something that we can all learn from, myself personally included. The better listeners we become, I think the happier we can become as human beings.
The idea for that really came to me from the Ohio poet James Wright.
Mm-hmm.
Who at a certain point in one of his latter poems says directly to the reader that he wants to have a talent for happiness. And I think that's a choice we begin to make. And it requires art, mm-hmm. as well as luck, as well as work. And that passage you just read occurs when I'm at an outdoor theater, a very visual theater, in Tampere, Finland. It's a revolving outdoor theater, and it's a musical that we're watching, but there's a lot of spectacle to it. And my friends who are with me are all visual people, and they're picking up a lot from this. And I'm, of course, picking up very little from it, except that I know Finnish, and they don't. So I at least understand how funny some of the songs are. And I'm thinking about the compensatory, as I said before, joy of listening, and that if I can give up feeling sad about not having all the visual effects, that people with good eyesight experience, then in point of fact, I've got a pretty good chance of being a pretty happy guy,
mm-hmm.
as I wander the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, of course, that's a choice.
Mm-hmm. And I love you have the there's a scene in the airport that some of the things that you endured at the airport, where some people have attempted to heal you, which is, those of us that know you, that's a pretty humorous and very I don't even know the proper word, obnoxious a way to approach someone. But in eavesdropping, you write it a bit about some of the occurrences that you've had to deal with during your travels, as you have traveled around the world, that other people don't have to put up with.
Yeah, the irony is I'm writing a book about the joy of traveling and listening, and at the same time, and I think any of the listeners to this program who have disabilities and travel will certainly understand this. You can also be a bit of a spectacle as the disabled person traveling on the airlines, traveling in the airport, needing assistance in certain situations, particularly if you travel by yourself. And much of this book, I do travel by myself. And there are lots of, I think, suggestive moments in the book where, you know, you see how old assumptions in the culture come swimming to the surface. As you point out, there are a couple of moments where I describe where people have walked up to me, invaded my space.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sitting in a cafe having wonderful thoughts, and somebody sails up and wants to know if they can pray for me. And you and I are both Episcopalians. I can say with a fair degree of confidence that there's nothing particularly wrong with me, and I feel pretty good with Jesus.
Yes.
But the notion that I need to be fixed is, of course, built into an old model of disability, that people with disabilities are either medical problems or they are, you know, spiritual or social problems. And the truth is, we're not a problem at all. Once universal design and the right architecture is in place, we simply don't have problematized lives. So that comes up several different places in the book. I get on an airplane and a strange man who purports to be a firewalker, who walks through flames, says he can cure people with illnesses if they just come to his ranch and walk through fire pits. And I pretend to fall asleep. It's my best method for dealing with him on that airplane. As you travel, if you're in a wheelchair or you have a guide dog or you have other mobility impairments, you also run into wonderful people who are really Johnny on the spot and understand, you know, issues and can help you out. And one shouldn't in any way feel a sense of reluctance to go traveling, just because there are some, you know, moments when, you know, they show up with a wheelchair and all you need is an escort to your next plane gate.
Right.
And, the you know, things like that happen. But for the most part, things are getting better.
Yeah. Since Planet of the Blind, which was published in 98, and also there's also a book of poetry, Only Bread, Only Light, published by Copper Canyon Press. Has it improved, Stephen, the situation as far as you're traveling around and doing your speaking engagements? Has it gotten any easier?
You know, one ironic thing is that with the creation of the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, the quality of security checks in our nation's airports has not only gotten, I think, better for everyone, as it should, but it's also gotten better for people with disabilities. Formerly, many disabled listeners here may relate to this, airports contracted out to local companies to do this. And the training for working with people with disabilities was either non-existent or up for grabs. And so prior to the tragedies of 9/11 and the transformation of security in the U.S., I often would be grabbed by people who spoke little or no English, who didn't understand what the dog was. Everything would come to a grinding halt. It could be just about impossible in some instances to, you know, get through security with dignity and certainly with, you know, efficiency. And the TSA does a great job. They really understand working animals. They've made it an important part of what they do. And, you know, the experience is so much more professional that you know, it, in that sense, it's perhaaps one of the sad ironies of 9/11, that after so much suffering and tragedy, that a small thing like this should get better. But it is much better for travelers with disabilities.
Good. One of the parts of the of eavesdropping published by Norton, you talk about cell phones, and that's a touchy subject with me as well, because I view it as it's just such an intrusive, become such an intrusive part of our culture. And you talk about when you first really began being exposed to it by just sitting there, and all of a sudden, two seats down, a guy's having, or a man or a woman's talking about a divorce thing they're going through, and now that's commonplace. Where it's you talk about the audible environment is shrinking, and the impact that cell phones. You say that it's even spread over over to Finland, that they're concerned about the effect of cell phones in their society as well.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. Finland, the Finns lay claim with some justice to being the nation that invented the cell phone.
Oh, really?
Nokia is a Finnish company. And I think this is amusing. In the 19th century, Nokia made rubber boots, which was a form of communication in Finland, if you think about it.
Okay.
Land of lakes and forests, you know, you'd put on your Nokias and slog through the marsh to get to your neighbor's house so you could have a conversation. But in the years just after World War II, they branched out into electronics, and they invented the mobile phone quite some time ago, and then successfully began marketing it, you know. The Finns are worried that text messaging is leading to a kind of corruption of their nation's grammar. And while that may seem like perhaps a silly fear, Finnish is one of the Finno-Ugrian languages, which is heavily inflected. It has 16 case endings. And as a result, shorthand and, you know, the strange hybrid forms of language that teenagers are inventing on the cell phone actually is changing their language. And so they've actually called a sort of a task force of their national parliament to look into what this means. So the cell phone has certainly arrived. It's a big transformation, both at the linguistic level in some countries and certainly at a social level in others. I was just talking with my sister the other day, who is a physician in New York City, and she said it's astonishing to walk down the streets of Manhattan and see absolutely everyone talking separately on their cell phones, and in so many cases having really intimate conversations.
Yeah.
As though the world didn't exist at all. There is no public space anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you find yourself, I find myself hearing things I'd rather not know about someone. And
right, and that's the section of eavesdropping that you're describing, that I'm early on, 1996 maybe, I'm traveling and I'm in LaGuardia Airport in New York City, and a woman is screaming on her cell phone. This is still when people were using payphones.
Right.
You know, so she had one of the first. It was big as a brick, I imagine, and, you know, and she's yelling at her divorce attorney in the most vulgar, you know, outrageous language. And I quote some of it. It comes across as something out of a Tom Wolfe essay.
I mean,
it's nutty.
Yeah.
What she's screaming about, and I realized, wow, public space is changing, maybe forever, and now it really has.
Yes, it has. And speaking of public places, I would like to mention that for those of you in Central Ohio, Mr. Cousisto and I will be having a discussion at the Barnes & Noble Easton store on September 20th at 7 o'clock, and we'll have eavesdropping available at the store that evening, and you can come and join us. We'll have a little bit of an interview, and you can come with your questions and meet Stephen. And so I would just like to put a little plug in there, because I think it's going to be a nice event, and one that a lot of people that would like to ask you questions will have a public forum where they can come and do that.
But you can only ask me questions if you call me on your cell phone.
That's right.
From the audience.
I've been in dorm rooms where the kids call across the or email themselves the questions.
Many of your blind listeners can probably relate to this. I have a cell phone with speech software in it from Verizon, and it will tell me who's calling if your name is in my contacts list.
Yeah.
So it will, and it, so you could just be in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and from the pocket of my pants will come this voice, call from Eric, call from Jose.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. The brave new world we're in.
Yes.
Stephen, one of the, in eavesdropping, you give credit to Donald Justice as being one of your teachers, and I'd like to just mention that for the listeners, if you've not read Donald Justice's poetry, I consider Donald to be one of our fine poets, and as you said, one of our best-read poets who recently died about a year ago. And how did Donald Justice influence you as a poet?
I discovered Don's poetry when I was a junior in college, and not coincidentally, my creative writing teacher was himself a former student of Don Justice's at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Jim Krenner is this poet's name. Jim gave me a copy of Don's first book, The Summer Anniversaries.
Mm-hmm.
Jim was always very generous about loaning his personal copies of books to students. And I went home and devoured that book cover to cover. That was Don's first book of poetry, published in 1959. He won a really good award for that. And I'm going to blank right now on the award. It wasn't the Pulitzer. He won that later.
Yes.
But it was a distinguished book of poems, to be sure. And to be in the presence of a mind that can write about contemporary issues but can also work with the beautiful, lyrical, and intricate measures and ironies of, say, the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Don had. He could write like a man who would sit next to you on the Greyhound bus, but with the kind of delicacy and intimacy of George Herbert.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a remarkable thing. I mean, one knows as soon as you start reading a poem by Don Justice that you're reading someone of extraordinary intelligence and talent.
Yes.
And I then devoured all of Don's books, and it became clear to me that the only thing I wanted to do after college was to go to Iowa and study with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I got lucky enough to do that.
Yeah, he wrote a long poem on insomnia, which is probably the best poem on insomnia ever written. He talks about being able to hear the static hum of the satellite towers at night when he wakes at 3 a.m. and some of his poems are just, they're brilliant, and he's greatly missed.
He was also, before he studied poetry, thinking about becoming a composer, and he studied classical piano and composition, in fact, with Carl Ruggles, noted composer and pianist himself. And he won a Ford Foundation grant to write a libretto at one point. So Don was a very gifted musician himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was a Renaissance man.
Yep.
In his time. Stephen, what are you happiest about between the time that's passed between Planet of the Blind and then the book of poetry, Only Bread, Only Light, and now Eavesdropping? What are you happiest about craft-wise with what you've pulled off with the new book?
Well, you remember the Seinfeld show. The joke about that program used to be that it was a show without a plot.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down after I conceived of the idea of writing Eavesdropping and made notes to myself, essentially underscoring the fact that this would have to be a book without a plot, that to take joy in listening, either from the past through memory or by making a bet with life that you could go somewhere and hear things that were full of merit and, you know, suggestive to the imagination, that either way, this book would not be a conventional memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And once I allowed myself to do that, then the writing of it became a real pleasure. And of course, it's my hope that when readers pick it up, they'll feel that pleasure in moments, places throughout the book, that I'm having a good time.
Yes.
Someone once asked Paul McCartney, why are the Beatles' songs just so gosh darn infectious? And he said, because even when we were mad at each other, we were having a good time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
And there's really been a movement in modern memoir to really more towards the maudlin, self-pitying. Well, self-pitying is probably not the right word, but tragic, tragic topics. And you have a very short piece about your mother called Pills.
Mm-hmm.
And had you wanted to, you could have taken that and blown that into something which would have gone more in line with what modern publishers are doing right now. And I must say I admired your restraint in handling that in kind of a poetic fashion, because I believe you wrote, Who Knows the Misery of Others?
Yeah.
And as we age, isn't that the truth?
It's the truth. And I remember I must have been about 12 when this is about when this memory comes from, understanding that my mother would walk all night around the house in agitation. And I also understood that she was taking pills, you know, and I could hear her agitation throughout the house. Just as you say, Don Justice, you know, can hear the static from the radio transmitters. Well, this was that kind of strange vatic listening that you can do in a quiet house. And I understood that she was a deep suffering person and that there would be a mystery in that, that I would never fully understand it, you know, and that came back to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I think also, like many writers, like many radio listeners, I have moments of profound insomnia, have had them all my life and still have them. And so, of course, one does some pretty interesting listening late in the night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And tell us, if you would, for a moment about your trip to Iceland. I thought that was one of the most intriguing sections of the book, when you went to see the Buena Vista Social Club. It sounds like you had just an incredible experience there.
Yeah, I'm fortunate to have a wife, Connie, who is open to these wild hairs when they happen. One afternoon, I was sitting around my office at The Ohio State University, and I got a call from an old friend from Iowa City, who is an attorney, Gary Whittington. Gary wanted to know if I would just drop everything, meet him in New York, and fly in about 2 days to Iceland to hear Cuban music in Reykjavik. Gary's an inveterate traveler, and Connie said, you know, give it a whirl. My sense of this was that, and I teach this in my nonfiction writing classes at Ohio State, is that sometimes you can make a little bet with life that it will give you interesting material out of which to shape a part of a story. And it struck me that hot Cuban musicians from Havana, who are even now thought of as almost national heroes in Iceland, that this had to be interesting.
Yeah.
What does Cuban music mean to people in Iceland? And what would the reception of that music be there? Of course, I'm familiar with dark, cold northern climes, having lived in Finland. So off we went. And what we discovered, of course, was that the entire nation, it seemed, turned out to hear the Buena Vista Social Club, including Iceland's president, the prime minister. Just about everyone was there. And the joy, the absolute tears of joy of the Icelanders as they listened to, you know, the bada drums that made their way to Cuba from Africa, and all of that Afrocentric percussion and those jazzy Latin tunes. The euphoria was very, very great. And then I discovered something about the landscape of Iceland and why perhaps Icelandic people might love that music so much. And it has to do with the volcanic sounds of their very own nation.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually an underneath part to Iceland, and it sounds like the Buena Vista Social Club.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And so that was just kind of a phone call. You're on the plane, you did it.
We did it. And much as I suspected, there were hidden parts to the story that I couldn't anticipate, that made it worth doing.
Absolutely. And then as Chuck Adkins, the show's producer, we were talking a little bit about baseball. You have some sections in Eavesdropping about baseball, which is a love of yours. And you talk about how you miss the organists at the baseball games. And we're close to the same age, and I can remember that as well. And the whole musical thing that goes along with the baseball game has kind of changed as well.
Yeah, and I don't want to sound like an old fart, you know.
Yeah.
Things change according to the times and the tastes, and I just went to a ball game in Seattle a few weeks ago, and you know, every pitch, between every pitch, they're playing bursts of rock and roll,
Yeah.
and it's a way to keep a younger crowd engaged in
Yeah.
the game. But for those of us of a certain age, we remember the almost funereal organ that they played at the ballpark, and they played it between innings, and it had a kind of old 19th century calliope quality to it. And it accentuated the slowness of baseball, which is, of course, why they're trying out the rock and roll now, I suppose. It's to make it seem faster and more in keeping with the video-centric high-speed generation's tastes. But the old organ, if you're of the generation Casey and I are, or you're a little older, you will remember how magical that was.
Yes, it was.
And the organists had a sense of humor.
Yes.
You know, they knew how to really play into what was going on with the game.
Yes, they did.
You know.
And then you have some gems, kind of, we won't give any of them away. They're in Eavesdropping, some of the things that you've heard and listened to as you've sat in the ballparks, that comments people have made. And that's part of the beauty of the book, is you give us access to the listening part of some things that that you've observed.
People say things in baseball stadiums because the game is slow. There's time to talk. And if you spend enough time hanging around ballparks, you will pick up some amusing speeches, impromptu utterances by people that come right out of what William Carlos Williams, the poet, called the American idiom. One guy actually says, and it's in that section of the book, he says, "Come on, honey, let's just drive west. Headaches aren't so bad west of the Mississippi." There's art in those crowds.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Stephen, talk for a moment, if you would, about what you're doing at Ohio State right now. We have Eavesdropping appearing in bookstores all over the place now. What are you going to be doing this fall as far as teaching, traveling for the book?
I'm not teaching in the fall quarter. I begin again in January. This past year, I got a wonderful opportunity from OSU, and I have become a professor of a new interdisciplinary program that we offer called Disability Studies. And so I'm teaching courses almost exclusively now that have to do with disability in literature, disability in film, history of disability, disability in culture. I'm still teaching some creative writing, which is how I began at Ohio State, and will always teach a little of it. But more and more, I'm teaching courses on the disability experience in memoir writing, or, as I said, disability in social history. And we have an interdisciplinary program in the study of disability that runs across the whole spectrum of the university. We're one of a handful of American universities pioneering this kind of program, along with University of California at Berkeley. And that school to the north, University of Michigan, Syracuse University, larger tier one public universities and privates are really going toward specialized programs in disability. So
That's
it's
fantastic.
an exciting time to be teaching and to be a person who has a disability and is interested in exploring what that means to both society and to individuals.
I'm excited to hear that. And then I can't let you go without finding out. I know you ran a marathon here a few years ago. And if you would, just tell us a little bit about that experience.
My wife, Connie, and I ran in a marathon that was sponsored by the American Stroke Association, which is a branch of the American Heart Association, national organization. We ran in a train to end stroke marathon. We trained for months. We were middle-aged people, so we had lots of liniment and bandages. The joke is that runners are the healthiest sick people you'll ever run into. And we then went to Kona, Hawaii, and ran in the Kona Marathon. And we both have T-shirts that declare us finishers, which, in fact, we got the honorable way. Although I crossed the finish line looking a little like Igor in the old Frankenstein movies. I'm kind of bent over. But running is something that we do together. Connie watches out for me, and I plod along behind.
That is great. That is great. Well, our guest today on Morning Exchange has been Stephen Kusisto, and we've been discussing his new book, Eavesdropping, which I highly recommend to all of you. It's currently available in bookstores. Planet of the Blind was published in 1998, Only Bread, Only Light, Copper Canyon, in 2000. And Stephen, thank you so much for taking time today to talk with us. And I hope that the local listeners will come out to Barnes & Noble Easton on September 20th at 7 o'clock, and we can continue the conversation and make some more new friends out there.
Thank you very much, Casey.